Okay, please help me welcome our speaker tonight. We have Maren from There's a Solution from Pennsauken, New Jersey.
All right. Good evening, everyone. How are we doing? Were these seats more expensive? Is that what the... Okay. My name is Maren Harwood. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. I want to thank the group for asking me to be here, and I want to thank God for that butter cake that we had. Did anyone have any of the butter cake? Come on now. That's the real MVP. Come on. It's delicious. I might have to take a nap halfway through this, but it was really good. Thank you, everyone, again. I really do appreciate it. So it's pretty interesting, right, when you get asked to speak, right, there's always this spot of like, well, what do we talk about? You know, there's so many different angles that we can talk about this thing, right? There's 12 steps, there's God, right? Those are the kind of the big stuff, but today's Labor Day, right? So if we think about what's the labor in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the 12th step, right? Working with others, right? We don't really get a day off in this thing. It turns out that not only is working with others the bright spot of my life today, it turns out that my life depends on it. So it's crucial that we understand, right, that working with others, without that, right, tells us right in the book, nothing so much ensures immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when all else fails, right? And examples of all else, there's all sorts of different all elses, calling your sponsor, prayer, meditation, right? There's all sorts of different things that fall short. But the one thing, right, that Dr. Bob says saves the day is working with another alcoholic. And this is Labor Day. So what we're going to talk about working with others, right? We're going to talk about the 12 steps. I just want to let you know that you're not going to hear any war stories from me. My war stories can't keep me sober. They're not going to keep you sober, right? So the idea would be, what is the solution to this whole thing? Let me qualify myself as a real alcoholic, right? Because not everyone in AA is a real alcoholic. I know that's shocking, but it turns out not everyone is. As a real alcoholic, whenever I put one in my system, I don't know how many I'm going to take, right? And every time I tried to stop on my own, I could not. Therefore, I was suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer, right? And that comes right out of page 44 of the book. If you're not sure if you're a real alcoholic or not, we can go right to that, ask ourselves those questions. If we're nodding our head up and down or saying yes to those questions and we're having a hard time with the spiritual concepts, I get it to a degree, right? What do they put on the, I don't know if everyone's from, I live in PA now, but like on the outside of all the liquor stores, what do they put on them? Wine and spirits, right? So if you think about it, we've had thousands of spiritual experiences. You don't have to admit this if you don't want to, but a definition of a spiritual experience is a profound change in perception, right? Anyone ever fallen in love before? Let the record show for Zoom. No hands went up and they're all lying. But if you've fallen in love before, you've had a profound change in perception. Right? Remember the first time you put alcohol in your system? Yeah, we all remember that. Right? My perception on life changed forever. So we've had spiritual experiences. That's one of the bigger hang-ups when people come in. They see the word God. They don't like God all that much because it reminds them of a God that was either shoved down their throat or one they tried to evade for years, right? They don't like that, especially don't like the amends process. And most of the time, they're undereducated about what an inventory is, so they're afraid of that, right? But when it comes down to it, they see spiritual experience and they think that they can't have one. You've had thousands. The idea would be we need to have one, right, that is a sufficient substitute for what we got when we put alcohol in our system, right? There are multiple different treatments for alcoholism, in case you're curious. Alcohol is a treatment for alcoholism, right? Narcotics are a treatment for alcoholism. Risky sexual behavior is a treatment for alcoholism. Gluttonous eating is really, if you think about it, anything outside of me to fix something on the inside. Right? They treat the underlying condition. The doctor's opinion tells us very clearly what the underlying condition is. Restless, irritable, and discontent. until I could feel the ease and comfort that comes from taking a couple of drinks. The question is, where are we getting our ease and comfort today? If it's just the butter cake, we might be in trouble. Right? Because guess what it does? It falls short. Every time. Right? When I try to place people, right, in front of all that, when I play, anyone ever lay some really heavy expectations on it, on someone, especially someone that they love, and then they happen to meet those expectations? If you're like me, we just ratchet it up to the next level. I like a good excuse to be resentful of people. And expectations are a great way to do that. So here's a little bit about my kind of roadmap to this whole spiritual awakening piece that I was talking about. It's rather simple, right? I was rotting from the inside out. I had no ability to connect on an emotional level with any other human being. I had no ability to maintain, keep, or anything positive in my life at all. But none of those things are what make me alcoholic, right? It's not what alcohol does to me that makes me alcoholic. It's what alcohol does for me that makes me alcoholic, right? Whether you drink in the morning or don't drink in the morning, whether you had a DUI, no DUI, gone to jail, haven't gone to jail, rehab, no rehab, none of that matters. It's all white noise. That's how we separate ourselves from people, it turns out, in AA too. Oh, I can't relate to that, right? You ever hear anyone say, like, oh, I can't relate to their story? Well, maybe they're telling too much of the war story side and not enough on the recovery side. I love when people say, oh, I love reading Bill's story. I can relate to Bill's story. You know, chapter one, page one of the big book, right? The founder of AA. I'm always like, what part do you relate to? Oh, I relate to burning my life to the ground. Oh, I get it. Then you're probably going to die an alcoholic death. We need to relate to the end of Bill's story. If we can relate to the end of Bill's story, we're going to have a lot better chance of surviving this thing. If we relate to just somebody's war stories, we're in big, big trouble. Because we're relating to the wrong piece. It tells us in this chapter called There Is a Solution, right? In that, it tells us that one of the pieces that bind us is, right, common peril, as he says. He's relating it to like a shipwreck. When everyone gets off the ship, they get rescued from shipwreck and everyone's super happy about it, right? They're common peril, but the cement which binds us, as the book says, is the recovery piece, the spiritual piece, the God piece, right? So I was 13 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous expecting the room to fix me. Anyone ever feel that way before? I'm going to go to this AA meeting because I need a meeting. How selfish is that? I go to AA to take just like I did my whole life. But that's what I was told. I was told to sit here and wait for the miracle to happen and take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth. And I was told to make 90 and 90. And like any good alcoholic, I did a 180 and 90. I was thinking about my favorite subject the entire time. Me. Anyone ever, you don't have to admit this. I'm going to say this for me. All right. Anyone ever sit in a meeting before and it's a topic meeting? Someone says a topic, right? Usually it's like humility or gratitude or something, whatever, right? They say and then you sit there and you think about your share. Yeah, this is what I'm going to talk about. Meanwhile, people are sharing, right? This is what I'm going to do. And then all of a sudden you get enough cojones to raise your hand, right? And then they call on you, you share, and then after you're done, you think about how good your share was the whole time. Anyone ever do that before? I can't be the only one, but don't admit it. We'll talk about it later. But think about that. What am I really trying to do there? Am I being altruistic? I know that seems like a big word, but it's really not. It's thinking about others before I think about myself. I think about me all the time, even today, right? But the solution to thinking about me is not a drink or a drug. It's thinking about you. That's where the work comes in. Right, so 13 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, taking every person that ever loved me at all and dragging them through the hottest of coals, the deepest of mud, all the pain and sorrow and anguish and frustration, those were just in the people that loved me the most. Right, so I dragged them all through all this for a long, long time. It took my mother 3 years in my recovery for her to sleep all the way through the night. Like, if we don't think we owe amends for stuff like that, I don't know what we're doing. Right. But that being said, I finally, this last time, I call my sponsor from rehab, right? Like any good sponsee. Yo, here's a meeting list with phone numbers on it. Call them if you're going to drink. Who has actually ever done that? and then not gone and drank after. I mean, it's in theory, it makes sense. Call these numbers and they might be able to help you. I'm sorry, but if I'm thinking about drinking, you could dig up Bill Wilson and prop him up right in front of me and he could 12-step me. And it's not going to stop me. Right? But see, a decision, I've made decisions too. We talk about that in the third step. I've made decisions, right? I'm going to drink a drug no matter what. Anyone ever thought about that before? I mean, that's the way my thinking was for a long time. It didn't matter. I'll figure it out this time. It'll be different this time. Right? What's the number one cause of relapse? Sobriety. Every time I relapse, I did it sober. My sober thinking is a liability because it says it'll be different this time. Right? I'll only do a little bit. I'll get it from the dispensary. Right? Whatever it is, it's from a doctor. No big deal. Right? Oh, it's only beer or a Zima at the barbecue. Like, whatever it is. Like, my brain will trick me into thinking it's a good idea. I know people laugh at that. No, Zima. Anyway, like, I don't even know if they still make it anymore. It still makes people laugh, so I'm going to continue to say it. So the idea is, how do we change our sober thinking? Right? That's the whole idea. So I call my sponsor from rehab. I tell him, as honest as I've ever been in my whole life, I tell him the straight truth. I don't want to live anymore. Anyone ever hear the friendly little asylum called Horsham Clinic? That's where I was. I did the state insurance route. Yeah. Right? There was no flat screens. Right? There was no Tempur-Pedic beds for me. Rubber pillows, mattresses, Medline, vital signs. Right? So I called up my sponsor and I told him I don't want to live anymore. And he asked me one question. Do you have your big book with you? And the funny part was I didn't even really know because I didn't pack my bags. My wife packed my bags for me this time. So I went and checked my bag and there is on top a perfectly pristine, untouched, unfolded, not even a coffee stain, not a highlight, not a nothing, fourth edition big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, yeah, Chris, I got it. He said, all right, sit down with someone in there and read the doctor's opinion. I literally, that was my reaction, was like, what? I'm not even technically sober. How can I help anybody? And then my sponsor, anyone who knows him, we can talk about him later, not in front of a microphone or on Zoom, but he's a very zen guy. And what he said to me was, maybe you'll learn something, stupid. See, that's how he had to talk to me. It hit something in my brain, right, that maybe I'll learn something. So I sat down with whoever would listen, and we talked about the doctor's opinion. Doctor's opinion, obviously physical allergy, mental obsession, right? I suffer from alcoholism sober, and then when I put alcohol in my system, I don't suffer from alcoholism anymore because I treated it with alcohol, right? Restless, irritable, discontented is before I take a couple drinks. That's what I'm trying to treat. That's what I use. Alcohol, drugs, women, food, coffee, whatever, to fix. Right? Is that restless, irritable, discontented, whatever it is. Whatever your twist is, it doesn't necessarily matter. We're using those things. Gambling, that's another one. Talk to me with your sportsbook app open. Come on. Anyway, so like whatever the case is, we're trying to fix something right in here. So we're talking about the physical allergy. What does a physical allergy look like for somebody like me? I react abnormally when I put alcohol in my system. If you want to get a good chuckle, right, talk to someone who's non-alcoholic and ask them what it's like when they put alcohol in their system. It's funny because they have to think about it. They're like, well, I don't know. I can feel a little out of control, a little fuzzy. My stomach hurts a little bit. And you know, but like, here's the thing. My reaction is very different than that. I feel in control, laser focused, and who cares about the job? I'll get another one. Like I literally have an abnormal reaction to it. It's literally a central nervous system depressant. It's supposed to make you go to sleep. Not me. It does something a little bit different for me. Right? It puts my mental GPS to be in Indiana, this little area in Kensington, Philadelphia. Right? It does a little something different with me than the general population. Okay? So that's a physical allergy. Now, if I'm allergic to something like that, here's great advice. Don't drink and make a meeting. Here's the problem. I got a mental obsession. I got a brain that tells me alcohol is a good idea. Right? That's the problem with the don't drink and make a meeting. Unfortunately, the meeting itself is not sufficient to overcome alcoholism. If it was, every person that walked into AA would never drink again. Turns out that's not the case. It's aimed a little bit different than it used to be. It used to be aimed at whenever someone walked into AA, we qualified them as a real alcoholic, and if they were a real alcoholic, we took them through the steps. Right then. Right, Bill Wilson talks about it in his story. He did, well, they were the tenants of the Oxford group. Okay, we can argue that till we're blue in the face, but he did all of them in his hospital bed. I don't know necessarily how much he was writing, right? He didn't make many direct amends right then and there, but he went out and did it. But he had, something happened to him while he was in that hospital bed. Little did I know something was happening to me in Horsham Clinic, but I had no clue yet. Right, so we talked about those things, and I did my little stay at Horsham Clinic. Then my insurance said it was cool for me to go to this nice little asylum called Eagleville Hospital. Anyone familiar with that one? Right, Eagleville Prison Light. Right, so that was my next stop in my journey. Right, I was continuing to talk to my sponsor, and he's saying the same thing. Keep reading the doctor's opinion. Find someone to read it with. Right, I had to share my big book with them because there was no big books in that place. Right, you couldn't find them anywhere. Turns out we go to treatment centers. The only thing we don't get are treatment, but that's a whole other thing. I work at a treatment center, so I can say that. It's okay. So after I was done, right, my sponsor picked me up at rehab. On the way, he drove me to his house, and we talked about the first three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rather simple. Powerlessness, easy to admit, right? I had to concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. I had to know what being a real alcoholic really was. We discussed those things. Unmanageability is an internal condition. It's got nothing to do with my life on paper and everything to do with my utter inability to manage my emotional states, right? When something seemingly good happens, I'm through the roof. Something seemingly bad happens, I'm down in the dumps and depressed. Sound familiar, anybody? It's the way a lot of us get misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder. If we tell a doctor that, they're going to like hand us a script for lithium, right? But the point is, if I can't handle my emotional states, there's no middle ground. Pinned. Nothing in the middle. Right? So that's what unmanageability is in the first step. If you haven't taken the first step of AA, you just did, if you can relate to all that. Right? Step number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Here's the main key with all this. You don't have to come to believe, you will come to believe. All you have to do is be willing in the second step, willing to believe there's a power greater than you. And if that starts off with just being on a spinning ball of mud, just the right distance from the sun, just the right amount of water and oxygen and food to sustain life, that's a power greater than you. Good start. Rock on. Let's start there. Right? Because whatever higher power it is you came into AA with wasn't sufficient. Let's be real. Right? I'm not trying to hurt anybody's feelings. Just saying. If it was sufficient, you wouldn't have to listen to my corny ass up here talking about this stuff. You wouldn't have to. You would just like gone to wherever and done whatever and you'd have been okay. A couple Hail Marys and you're good. Unfortunately, there's deeper issues there, right? And if we're going to restore an old car, what does that mean? We bring it back to its former glory. That's what restore means. Sanity means soundness of mind. So that means in the second step, that implies that we at some point had a sound mind. That's what the second step tells us, right? The third step tells us when that is. So made a decision, right? A decision is only as good as the action that follows. I would like for the record to indicate I have decided to drop my cell phone onto the ground. Let the record show I didn't drop my cell phone on the ground. So I made a decision, but a decision without action is fantasy. Doesn't mean a thing. So a decision in the third step, we turn our will and our life, which directly translates to our thoughts and our actions, which typically when we come into AA isn't all that good. Thoughts and our actions, not great, usually geared towards selfishness and self-centeredness, right, typically. Right. So in the third step, it tells us we had to be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And then it starts talking about the actor in the third step. Anyone ever read that part, page 60 to 63 in the book, where it talks about the stage character I portray to the world? The self I show you is not the self that's in here. It's not the self that God created. It's the one that I created. Right? And then we got to get down to causes and conditions and peel off the layers of the self that God created for us in here. Right? That's really what the whole deal is with this. Now, when I turn that right over to the care of God, as we understood him, right? The last time we had soundness of mind is when we were cared for, when we were infants. Anyone that's ever held a baby knows this, right? That we were born with the three pillars of spirituality: faith, love, and trust. You're holding this little human being, right? Looking up at you, right? We are born with it. We have it already. And if you're breathing in and out, I can't see everyone, but I'm assuming they're all breathing in and out, we still have the capability to tap into that. Faith, love, and trust, right? That's our decision. Our decision is to get restored back to a place, right, of soundness of mind, right, will and thoughts, right, thoughts and life, get turned that over. To turn something over means to shift or adjust it elsewhere, right? So where it was now, not good. Where it's somewhere else, faith and trust and love, that it's going to be good. Right? That's all it is. It is an exercise in faith. And if we're not convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success, we're not going to do it. Right? So that's why having this conversation was super important for me. I had to understand that what I was doing wasn't working. I just fresh out of Eagleville Hospital, I thought I could handle everything. Literally thought like, no problem. I got this. Right? 25 days sober, thinking I got it handled. So then, after that, we get to his place. He slides me a notebook across the table. I guess you can see where this is going now, right? He slides me a notebook across the table and starts talking about resentments. Resentment is a Latin word from centaur, which means to feel. Resentment means to re-feel the same emotion over and over and over again, whether it's real or imagined. So here's an example from my inventory. My father, right? And I was resentful at him because he never told me he was proud of me, right? And I never thought I'd live up to his expectations. The parts of self that were affected by that were my self-esteem, my ambition, and my personal relationship with him. So my sponsor leans back in his chair and he asks me, "How was your father raised?" Well, my father was raised by a physically abusive alcoholic Quaalude addict, right, who abused verbally and physically his entire family until he could escape and go to the Navy. And so my sponsor asked me if my father ever physically abused me. And I'm sure you can guess by now, I've heard thousands, feels like, of inventories. There's some really terrible things that happen to kids. And that's all I'm going to say about that. That's not part of my story. So I mentioned that, no, he never physically abused me. So at that point, I have two sons at my house that I haven't gone back to yet. So my sponsor looks at me square in the eyes and he says, "So you mean to tell me that your father may have stopped the cycle of physical abuse from father to son in your family tree forever? Did you ever consider that?" Like, that's how skewed my perception is. I can't see past me. Let alone see what, like, that's another thing. Can you imagine, right? My father does not have this illness, and he's watching his son act just like his dad did. Gets chills up and down my spine thinking about that. Like, no wonder. No wonder he was so closed off to me for so many years. I reminded him of his dad. Right? So that's just one resentment. And then how I refelt that was every single other adult male relationship in my life, I tattooed that exact same resentment on them. I never thought I'd live up to their expectations, and I never thought they'd be proud of me. On my teachers, my coaches, my sponsors, everybody, peers, coworkers, bosses, you name it. That one resentment tattooed itself onto every single other adult male my whole life. That's why when we deal with resentments, they are infinitely grave to the alcoholic, right? Because the ripple effect from them, it goes well beyond what we can see. So much further than that. That's why with the inventory, we have to get down to causes and conditions. got to understand where I'm inconsiderate, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid. If I don't see those things in all my personal relationships, then I'm going to continue to do the same things over and over again. Constantly, over and over. I'm going to use people just the same way I use substances. It's going to be the same thing. Right? Constant. So that's what the inventory is about, getting down to causes and conditions. Now again, I taught it in the very beginning, this is Labor Day, we're talking about work. We're not talking about my work that I've been doing, we're talking about what my sponsor did. That's the work. He sat me down the day I got out of rehab, and we wrote a full inventory, took a couple hours, wrote an inventory, shared it with him, right? Prayed the prayers in the sixth and seventh step, right? Then we talked about the eighth step, which is only two sentences in the big book. I already made the list. I made it when we took inventory. Am I willing to make direct amends to them? If the answer is yes, then rock on. So what he did was he brought me home. My wife had a little spot set up for me on the couch. He gave me this direction. Make amends to your wife and your two kids the second you walk in the door. Don't unpack a bag. Don't get a water. Don't do anything selfish before you make amends to them. Because they deserve it. I had the dog there, so he said, practice on the dog. Which I did, right? And I made amends to my kids, were very little at the time. They just were happy to see me. And then I sat down with my wife and I made amends to her. I let her know that I was inconsiderate of her and her feelings. I was dishonest with her. I was afraid she might find out who I really am and not love me for who I really am. Right? And I validated myself and what she thought of me, so I always told her what she wanted to hear, what I thought she wanted to hear, and that from here on out, I'm going to do everything I can with God's help, even though I didn't even believe in God, to be honest. I was willing to, but at that point, I didn't really believe. I was willing to, though. That's the thing. See, my life was on fire, right? And my soul was rotting. So I was willing to believe almost anything. I told her with God's help, I'm never going to repeat those things ever again. She looked at me square in the eyes and said, I'll believe it when I see it. And he said, my sponsor's like, listen, a mumbling that we're sorry is not going to cut it. If you say you're sorry, you have to do it again. I don't want to do it again. I don't want to do it the first time, let alone again. Right? The idea is, if we think about all the people that we love, and if we had a little counter over our head, one of those little flip counters, right? Of how many times we said we were sorry to them. I bet you those numbers are astronomical. Sorry doesn't mean anything anymore. It's not the point of all this. The point of all this is to clean up our side of the street, right? And we do that with the parts of self, right, that we brought to the relationship. The hidden fourth column on page 67. For further amplification, see me after the meeting. We'll go over all that, right? So then, and my sponsor says, I'm going to pick you up at 6 tomorrow. And I said, 6 p.m.? He said, no, 6 a.m. So he picks me up at 6 in the morning. We go over this part in the book on page 86 called On Awakening, right? And then after that, we talked a little bit about the 10th step, how you don't have to take an inventory every year. That's terrible advice, by the way. You ever hear anyone say that? I do a 4-step every year. Then you're skipping 10? It's basically like cleaning your house once a year. Probably not going to look good 6 months in. Just saying. Right? The idea would be to clean up as we go along. The reason we do a drastic self-appraisal is so we can do smaller ones as we go along so it doesn't have to be so drastic anymore. Right? So that's the idea. We clean up as we go along. So then he taught me that what we do on awakening, right? And page 86 to 88, thinking about 24 hours ahead, right? Pause when agitated or doubtful. It tells us to there's a few prayers in there. We read that stuff. And then he said, did you bring your inventory with you like I asked? And I said, yes. Took it out. He said, circle the top 5 names on there that are closest geographically to us. Circle the names. My hand, I'm shaking like a leaf. This is the inventory. I'm shaking. Making phone calls. Setting up amends. He drove me around, made close to, including my family, about a dozen amends. This is 26 days sober. And you know, I'm thinking, here's the thing with amends, right? I always used to think I knew what people are thinking and what they're going to say. You don't have to admit this either. If you're anything like me, you've had conversations, full-blown conversations with people in your head, knowing what they're going to say, and then not had the conversation in real life because you know how it's going to go. That's lunacy, by the way. That is complete delusional thinking that we know what people are thinking and what they're going to say. It's absurd. You're fired from that, by the way. My sponsor did that for me, and I thought that was great. You're fired from knowing what people are thinking and knowing what they're going to say, because you're terrible at it. Anyway, so we went around and did all that. I'm afraid every time I got back in the car, too, he'd be looking at me smiling. He's this bigger guy looking at me smiling. He's like, "Isn't it great you know God better?" I'm like, oh, I'm so mad at him. I wanted to punch him. He's bigger than me, so I wasn't going to do that. Right? I still had some brain power left, right? But I was, "Oh, ain't it great you know God better?" Big smile. "Ain't it great you know God better?" "Oh, stop saying that," right? And so it was just like that. It was like gut-wrenchingly corny and cheesy, right? That's the way it felt with me in here, right? Little did I know it was actually working. I didn't know yet. So then when he brings me back to the house, he said, "So here's what I need you to do. Before you go to bed, there's this little part called When We Retire at Night on page 86, a little paragraph. Read it and do what it says." I said, "Do you have to write anything down?" He said, "Does it say to write anything in there?" I said, "No." He's like, "Okay, all you have, listen, if it doesn't say it in the book, it's someone else's opinion. The only opinion that matters is the doctor's opinion. Leave your opinions out, and if everyone else has opinions about your recovery, let them say what they need to say, tell them they might be right, and move on. Because if it ain't in the book, it's not how they got better back then. And how they got better back then was at a rapid clip." So he suggested that at every meeting I go to, I raise my hand and say I'm looking for people to take through the steps because my life depends on it. Next meeting, he brings me to a meeting, right? It's funny how after these 2 days, like, he brought me to a meeting after we did the steps. Usually it's the opposite. "Well, let's go to a meeting and then we'll have coffee afterwards and we'll go to a diner or whatever." Like, he knew, we perform triage. Our work in AA is triage. Anyone familiar with that? Right? Triage is basically these little guys that will run around with first aid kits on battlefields and try to determine whether the people that are laying on the ground bleeding out are worth saving or not. Right? That's when someone comes into AA, they're worth saving because they're breathing in and out. They're still alive. There's still a hope. There's still a chance. And then we tell them to sit there and wait for the miracle to happen. They go out and die, and we say, "Oh, they just weren't ready." BS. They came in the door, they were ready. I just didn't offer them the treatment to alcoholism. That's the problem. We're not offering treatments for alcohol. That's the work. The work is being uncomfortable with what you're offering the newcomer. If you're comfortable with what you're offering the newcomer, it's just a piece of butter cake. Ain't sufficient to overcome alcoholism. So I went to the meeting the next day with him. It's this meeting, they don't have it anymore. It was a Friday night at Holy Family University. A cat named Chris Brennan ran the big book meeting, right? They asked for any AA-related announcements. I raised my hand like a goofball and let him know that I'm looking for people to take through the steps because my life depends on it. He gave me the old, like, little tip of the hat. He liked that. Chris Brennan did. And then after the meeting, someone comes up to me. Shaky little new guy, 3 days sober, said, "I heard what you said. Can you help me?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "How much sobriety time do you have?" My sponsor prepped me with an answer for that. I said, "Enough to be useful. Let's get started right now." You see, anyone that knows the history of AA, Ebby Thatcher, we're familiar with that cat, right? Ebby Thatcher was one that approached Bill Wilson. After getting basically getting sober through the Oxford group, they told Ebby, "Go find the worst drunk you know and offer him a treatment." Ebby Thatcher was 2 months sober when he approached Bill Wilson. It's a good thing no one told Ebby Thatcher to wait a year to help people. We might not be here today. When Ebby Thatcher approached Bill Wilson was drinking gin at his kitchen table. It's a good thing they did not tell Ebby Thatcher to stay away from people, places, and things. We might not be here today. Right? So that being said, my sponsor knows that sobriety time means as much as your shoe size in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I get it. If we're proud of our sobriety time, that's great. Go ahead. Hoorah, hoorah. How many people are you helping? right? What are we doing to sharpen our mind, right? How are we feeding our soul? How are we feeding our mind? How are we helping other people? What are we doing to sharpen the axe so that we're not working so hard at doing what we should be doing and helping other people? The work. So I sat down with this cat. We're sitting there, right? I didn't have like a lot of like trust still at home. So I didn't have enough time to sit there and do an inventory with him on the spot. But I showed him where it was in the book, right? We have to be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Read pages 60 to 63, right? You read those. If you're like in agreement that this is me, okay, great. It tells us after that, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action. So right after the third step, next we launch out. The book was printed in 1939. It was written between 37 and 39. Were they launching rockets in 1937? No. That was in the 60s or something. You know what they were launching? Boats. They were launching boats from a harbor out into the ocean without GPSs, without knowing what the weather is going to be. They did it in faith and trust. When we launch out on a course of vigorous action, it's doing it that way, in the faith and trust that this is going to do something. This is going to help. It's going to be okay. Right? That's what we launch out on this course of vigorous. We know vigorous, right? We've had $20 in your pocket and you're starting to feel sick. That's vigorous. We know vigorous. And yet we come in and we need to write an inventory. Yeah, I'm going to chill out on that for a little bit. That's good for you. I'm good on all that. Because I have old ideas about it. I've taken somebody else's fears about it and made them mine. Right? Angry John at our local clubhouse told me I don't need to do an inventory. Because we don't want to drudge up all the stuff that's inside there. It's already in there. We want to drudge it up. We got to get it out. Right? That's what the inventory's for. Right? So, I get a call the next day from Mike. Maren, I stayed up all night and wrote an inventory. I want to share it with you. So I go to my wife, right? Do I got time? Yeah. I go to my wife. I say, hun, all right, this is going to sound crazy. This guy, I talked to him last night. I told him to write an inventory, and he actually did it. Rare, right? Right? And he wants to share it with me. Can I use the car to go over to Jersey and meet him over there? She said, yeah, sure. And I'll tell you why. Because while I was in rehab, my sponsor made a phone call over to my wife and said this. Said, if Maren gets out of rehab, right, and he starts talking about getting the job back, right, getting a new car, getting some money in the bank account, bolt down the TV because it's going to wind up in Kensington at the pawn shop. However, if he comes home and he starts talking about inventories, God, prayer, helping others, he's going to be just fine. Let him go do it. Tosses me the keys. I go to a diner in Jersey. Believe it or not, there's diners in Jersey, right? Go to a diner in Jersey. Hear this dude's inventory. I don't even know how long it was. I want to say it was like 3 or 4 hours. We're sitting there just going back and forth, chugging coffees. Our waitress loved us. We're just big books open, not hiding a thing. Inventories out, laughing, crying, all the above, right? Going back and forth, talking about inconsiderate, dishonest, self-seeking motives, and just, it was powerful. So I got back in the car. He gave me a big old hug, thanked me, and got back in the car. It was like a 40-minute drive home. Two things happened on that ride home that drastically had a spiritual experience is, a profound change in perception. Two things happened. Halfway through that drive, realized that the radio wasn't on. Now, that might not seem like that big of a deal, but it made me realize I was at peace with me and my thoughts. I was able to sit with me for 20 straight minutes and not have outside noise. And then the next thought flooded in. That thought that happened, the next one, is still true to this day, and by far, believe it or not, I say some controversial things in AA, is the most controversial. Still true to this day. I had realized it had been 27 days without a thought or obsession to use drugs or alcohol. that is still true to this day. From December 27, 2014, till this moment right here and right now, there has not been a thought or an obsession to use drugs or alcohol up here. That's God. That is not me. The second I put alcohol in my system at 13 years old, until right then, 27 straight days without a thought or obsession to use drugs or alcohol. Still true, right? You hear people talk about it all the time. They use it in a derogatory sense. Well, kid, you're going to fall off the pink cloud. You don't have to. Who are you to say that somebody else is going to fall off a pink cloud? How selfish is that? Just because your angry ass, right, fell off and hit the bottom a bunch of times, doesn't mean that they have to. We're not offering to the newcomer what they used to offer to the newcomer. You know what they used to offer to the newcomer? Permanent recovery. That God can remove, God could and would if he were sought, remove that obsession. That obsession doesn't have to come back. And you're going to have a purpose-driven life at helping other alcoholics. The real sick ones, right? The ones that are just like you. Oh, well, you gotta give it away to keep it. Anyone ever hear that? That's a direct contradiction to the big book. You have to give it away to get it in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only way this thing actually works. You complete the circuit by helping other people. That's the work. Labor Day. Right? I'm not talking about building this pavilion. Right? Well, if you think about it, pretty good metaphor, right? Did they build this pavilion while it was raining? No. They built it in case it rains. Just like the steps. We do the steps before we need them. We build the pavilion before it rains. So if you happen to be lucky enough to be living in this spot that might be a sober living community, you might be at a PHP, IOP level of care, you might be any one of those things, you might have people that are going to hold you accountable, that right now you're in that kind of a grace period. Build the pavilion before you need it. Because once you move out, you're going to be going along, right, life's journey, and all of a sudden life's going to hit you. You're not even going to see it coming. And you're going to seek ease and comfort. If the pavilion is built, we seek ease and comfort through self-sacrifice and working with others. Prayer, meditation, ask God to remove it, right? Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone that we can help. Make amends if need be, right? Even if that means just not being a you-know-what for a little while. Just keep your mouth shut if you're me. God bless me with an ability to run my mouth. Right, so if sometimes being quiet is good enough for somebody like me, right? So the idea would be don't hurt anybody along the way. If you do, or should I say when you do, make amends to them right away. They deserve it. There's a lot of people dying from this thing. I know there's not news to anybody. All you have to do is go to a local clubhouse and look at the cork board and see all the obituaries on it. You ever really think about that for a second? That means those people with those obituaries that are on that cork board have been in that building before. If we could ask those people if they were offered a treatment for alcoholism, or if they were offered just another seat, what do you think would be the last thing they heard when they left that clubhouse? Keep coming back. Bless you. That is terrible advice for a newcomer. Keep coming back. That implies that they're not powerless. Right then and there, are you one of us? Great, here's my hand. Freedom's on the other side. I could show you where that is. It's right in the book. Maren, I don't know how to help people. It's in the book. We're not hiding it. You know those blue books that are at your clubhouse covered in dust? They used to prop open the door? No, it's in there. The answer's in there. We're hiding it right in front of you. I watched them put it up. They moved the food so they could give you the answer. The answer's not me, it's this. That's the work. Do the inventory. Make amends to people in your life because they deserve it. Find other alcoholics to help because your life depends on it. Thank you so much, guys. Appreciate you.